morning, world travelers and diners. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning and Merry Christmas, Peter. We're two days away.
I guess and happy birthday to Adam, our son, if he happens to be listening.
Yeah, he just turned 30.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I said.
makes us feel ancient.
Well, I won't comment on that one.
But Anne was a child bride, of course.
I was. But we're welcoming you to this show because, as usual, we have a great lineup of guests talking about the wild world of food, wine, and travel. Don't forget to find out what we're doing, where we are, by checking out our website, which is www.onthemenuradio.com. And do email us at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And here we have, I'm dying for this. I mean, you're going to drool through this whole segment, listeners, because we have Claire Clark, who's author of Indulge, 100 Perfect Desserts. And believe me, they are indulgent. Claire is also the pastry chef at the French Laundry restaurant in Yountville, California. This is the best restaurant in the world, just about, or at least the best restaurant in the United States. What do we say about that, Claire?
Wow, what a build-up.
Yes. So welcome, Claire.
Well, Merry Christmas to you and Peter.
Right.
And the British are coming, right? The British are coming once more.
Oh, yeah, we landed.
Yes.
I was talking to Robert Irvine. I don't know if you know the name, who's on one of the food channels. He and I agreed that the British were conquering the world again by taking over the kitchens.
Yeah, it's about time. It's been a while since English food has some credibility.
Oh, we've seen the transformation. Yes, it's an amazing transformation.
That's good.
Yeah, I used to lose pounds by the minute when we were in England. Now I gain.
But this is a fairly high profile position in California at the restaurant, the French Laundry, that Anne, of course, noted its acclaim. But you had a pretty strong career before you went there.
I did, yeah. I've been working in the West End of London, actually, for 20 plus years. At places like Claridge's and the Ritz Hotel and, working in Michelin-style restaurants. And I set up a pastry department for the House of Commons for our government.
I thought that was interesting. What did that involve? I saw that in your resume.
That was great. I mean, every day you walked into the House of Commons, so through the security, and you feel very important. But they actually, at the time, didn't have a kitchen that was completely functional for cooking for the MPs. They had a high-class restaurant, but not where they could, have a posh meal, but nothing where they could get, meals throughout the day. And so they wanted to set up a kitchen for doing just that, for cooking from breakfast through to lunch and dinner, at all different levels. And so they asked me to join the team to head up the pastry department. So I was actually involved in designing a pastry kitchen within the building and then training some of the existing staff that were there and also putting in a brigade of pastry chefs and training them.
And you made things a little bit more particular than spotted dick, I assume.
That's right. Oh, do you know them? MPs, they love those desserts.
All the comfort foods were
their favorite. Rice pudding.
Here's the question. Did they like cabinet pudding?
Yes, they did.
Perhaps you don't even know what cabinet pudding is.
I do know what cabinet pudding is. It's like it's an egg custard dish with like bread and raisins and sultanas in it.
But it sounds like all those puddings mother-in-law makes.
The genuine version, which I had when I was at the University of Cambridge in the college dining room, was actually made with all the week's leftover pieces of dessert.
Oh, yuck.
With an eggy custard thing on top.
Very special.
And then it was served with the most disgusting tasting fruit sauce you've ever had in your whole life.
Oh, dear.
You had to be hungry to eat it.
That doesn't sound like a pleasant memory.
So what was Tony's favorite dessert?
Well, I have no idea.
He didn't come in, I guess, right?
He probably did, but
he probably went home and had Sherry cook him something for lunch.
Tell us about the Wolseley. You seem to have an affinity for places that are hard to get into. We never were able to get into the Wolseley, and we managed only once at the French Laundry.
The Wolseley's great. It's very, very, it's an old classic car showroom. It's a beautiful, beautiful building, beautiful pillars, high ceilings. Beautiful glass in the windows and the doors. It's it's just one of those. It's like a Viennese tea room, but on a grand scale. And the food is very brasserie, very traditional French, Viennese, Austrian brasserie style food.
And of course,
it's very, very popular. That's why you probably had difficulty eating it.
It's filled with celebrities, I understand. Did you see any celebrities?
Yeah, one day I was just walking up through the floor up to go to the offices, which were, you know, obviously the kitchen's right down there in the basement. So I came up to the floor level and up to the offices upstairs. And Robbie Williams was just sat there eating his dinner, and I walked right by him.
Oh, my.
I was like, and Johnny Depp. I saw Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp, oh, that's one, yeah.
Yeah.
He stayed at, where was it, Bath?
We did talk about the fact that he stayed with his entire family at the Royal Crescent in Bath. And
yeah.
They had a particular part of the hotel where he stayed, and apparently they said he was a really super guy, just down to earth and just a family guy and as humble as all could be, and it was just a pleasure to have his family staying there.
He wasn't there when we were there.
Now, you worked at the Wolseley with Chris Galvin, right?
I did, yeah, and I also worked with Chris Galvin in 1984 at the Ritz.
We had a bit of a joke
that we made it over the road in 20-odd years.
That's funny.
Well, he's a super guy. I mean, it's Galvin Bistro Deluxe and the restaurant at the Hilton, which looks down over the gardens of Buckingham Palace, is really a splendid place, too. So.
And then he's that new place, doesn't he?
I think he might be opening somewhere else.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, how did you get from there to Yountville, California, which is quite you talk about journeys from London to Yountville is quite a, change of scene.
It was. Well, Thomas was looking for a pastry chef and had been looking in the States for about a year and hadn't found anybody that he particularly liked. And so he put an advert in a local catering magazine in England, and I didn't actually see the advert, but a friend told me, and I first of all thought, well, I don't want to go to California. I'd like to go to the French Laundry, but that's an awful long way from my friends and family. So I didn't really think about it. Then I, you know, a week later, I thought, well, you know, maybe, what am I doing? Where am I going to go work next? And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll just go and find out about it. So I met Thomas one afternoon in a hotel lobby. We talked, and then he came up to the Wolseley in the evening and had a meal and some dessert, and then invited me to go to come out here to do a trial for him. And I came out here about 2 months later, and then like a month after that, I was here. So.
Now, what's it like to work for this man? He's viewed as being a bit of a perfectionist.
He's a total perfectionist.
Total perfectionist.
24/7 around the clock.
So what is it you think that made your work stand out?
I think, you know, what one of the things that Thomas admires is the basic skills done to the highest perfection. And I think, you know, if you have base skills that are you can do extremely well, then you can also build on those. But
when
if you
he
don't
said,
have the base skills to start with, then, you know, it's very difficult to build. Like I always say pastry is like building a house. You have to lay your foundation. And there's lots of things within pastry that are, you know, several different layers on top of, you know, on top of each other. It's like if you have a cake, you make the cake and then you split it and you fill it and you soak it and you mask it and you decorate it. Well, if you haven't got a good cake in the beginning,
yeah, right,
you know, it's you haven't formed your foundations.
Right. When he says that his most favorite of your desserts is the shortbread,
that's right,
which is your mother's recipe.
That's right. I wasn't too sure in the beginning whether I should be like upset about that or not. But having said that, it's just a really good recipe. It's four ingredients. You know, it really is simple to make. It's a great recipe, and it tastes fantastic.
You know what? On the show, it was about a year ago, we had the U.S. CEO of Walker's Shortbread, which is still to this day made in Scotland from the same recipe. Probably a lot like your mother's. That wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, I think that probably we're talking about two different levels of
execution. I don't know. Okay, well, I just thought I would inject that. And the other thing I thought was interesting, and I'd be interested in your comment on this, we had a very interesting interview with the pastry chef at the Windsor Court Hotel in New Orleans. And she was just very, very, very eloquent about the art of making desserts. But she said something very interesting, I thought. She said, pastry is so much more precise. He said, you have to get the measurements right. There's no way to recover. You can't resource something. You can't add a piece of ingredient. It has to be perfect from the very beginning.
And she's quite right, you know. And baking's a science, you know.
Yes.
And it's like, if it says 2.5 grams of baking powder, it means 2.5 grams of baking powder. Because, you know, you add 0.5 of a gram more, it's going to bubble up and come over the side of the pan and then probably collapse again.
Now, Claire, you said you don't use cups.
No.
Now, you have a very interesting description of why in your book.
Yeah, because the cup measure is not, it's for measuring volume, not, for measuring liquids, not solid. And one is not the other. You know, when I started to do the book, I thought, well, you know, people use these cups, so I'm going to phone the cup people and say, right, there must be a conversion from cups into grams or cups into ounces. And every single one of them said, no, because it's not meant for measuring, you know, flour and sugar. That's not what it was intended. And of course it isn't, because it's actually a liquid. It's meant for measuring liquids. And I was like, wow, that's incredible, because everybody bakes with these cups. It's like a common thing for everybody to bake with them.
Yeah, home
bake. But there is no translation, because it cannot be correctly translated.
Yeah, no, because different ingredients or weight have a different specific gravity.
Exactly.
There's a chemical term.
Yeah, and it can't be, you know, it's like my cup is going to be different to your cup. Who's going to say that, you know, you're going to bang it down and level it, and somebody else might just scoop it out and it might have, you know, a little bit extra on top or a little bit under. Well, in pastry, that matters.
So you do grams and ounces?
I do grams and ounces.
And the book is in what? I can't remember. Oh, okay, there you go.
Yeah, no, tell me this. Given that, which is almost alien to many home cooks, although I think it's coming around now. I mean, I did a cookbook years ago now, and the cups and whatever won out, but I don't think that the recipes worked very well, and I don't think today that necessarily you would do that. But given this, how easy is it to... I look at these desserts in the book. The photographs are fabulous. And I would like to make these. I don't bake at all. How easily could I reproduce any of these recipes?
Okay, well, there's a mixture of recipes in the book. So there are things like the shortbread, which is four ingredients, sugar, butter, flour, and vanilla. There's the lemon posset, which is under the custard section. It's three ingredients. And it is probably the best recipe in the book. It is such a wonderful, wonderful dessert. It comes like a creamy custard.
Is it because of proportion, or why is it so perfect?
It's because you boil the sugar and the cream, and then you add the lemon juice. And the lemon juice acts as an acid, so it sets. It kind of curdles it, but it doesn't curdle it in a way that it splits. It just curdles it in the fact that it sets it. So you end up with this beautifully lush, smooth, as it's like a creme brulee without the eggs.
Wow.
And all you do is boil the sugar and cream and add the lemon juice. And people say, no, but it can't be that easy. What have you done to it? And I said, no, that is what you do. And it is that easy to do. And there are recipes in the book, you know, not one or two of them, 10, 15, 20 out of the 100 that are that simple.
Yeah, and you have this...
And are wonderful.
You have the secrets of success in all the chapters, too.
That's right.
So that should help. Well, when I try it, I'll give you a holler.
Good.
Now, anybody can obviously get this book by going on our website on themenuradio.com, OTM Bookshelf, and it'll be there, and you can order it directly. You must also have a website, right?
For the restaurant.
Oh, it's on the rep. Okay.
Yeah, you can go to thefrenchlaundry.com and also absolutepress.com, which is the publisher.
Okay.
There we go. Now, so you talked about some of your favorites already. I have a question. I mean, how many of these recipes did you invent yourself? I mean, shortbread isn't a new invention, although it's a special recipe.
No, I think they're not, you know, all recipes are partly come from somewhere else. I don't think, you know, in this day and age, someone really. I mean, people do take, but it's normally part of a history from somebody else's recipe, and you adapt them and then call them your own. And there are things that are definitely within the book, like the green tea jasmine mousse, or the let me see what else is there. There's several other things that I have definitely had recipes and adapted them and made them my own. But those base recipes were actually from somebody else.
Now, are you doing anything molecular like Kestenblumenthal and crew?
No, you're not
into that. So what?
No.
So if I said, what do you think of bacon ice cream? You'd probably say, I think it's a silly idea.
No, I actually ate at the Fat Duck last year. And
it's good,
you know,
isn't it?
I love the scrambled egg. Yes, it is. And I love the scrambled egg and bacon ice cream. I really do. I think it's a smashing dessert. But you see, even that is actually based on even though it's molecular cookery and science, it's still based. You know, I mean, the base of that dessert is like a brioche that's been caramelized.
Right.
You know, so there's still things in there that are related to historical recipes.
Well, yes, it's kitchen science, right?
Yeah. So it still makes sense, even though you don't indulge, it makes sense.
Yes, it does.
And the other question I had was, your presentations are so perfect, as is everything at the French Laundry in terms of presentation. How far a stretch was that? Did you already have perfect presentations, or did you work a lot on that with Thomas?
No, I think I'm very, you know, all my teachers and mentors said that very early on, the thing that they noticed is that how precise I was. And that's probably why I'm a good baker. So,
yes.
From, you know, very, very early on in my late teens to my early 20s, they were already saying, like, you know, I'm so precise and accurate and methodical, which makes good pastry chef.
Now, give us a recommendation or a couple of recommendations for a dessert for Christmas Day upcoming.
I think if you want an alternative, there's another recipe in the book that's fantastic. It's the fruit falls. Again, it's just taking some sweetened cream with some vanilla, or I'd also recommend that if it's for Christmas, something festival, you could add some kirsch or some amaretto liqueur and some fresh fruit puree, and making a fruit full. And they are absolutely stunning. They're in the center of the book, and you can see there's just a little quirky presentation there. And, you know, they're really light after a heavy meal, so you know, you don't want too much to eat. You can make them in a small shot glass, so it's a small portion, and they taste good.
And that's wonderful.
Well, that's a wonderful suggestion. Now, listeners, let's suppose that you're fortunate enough to be able to snag a reservation at the French Laundry. What's the recommendation? The recommendation is, please be sure to leave room for pudding.
Yeah.
Claire, thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful holiday, and it was a delight to have you as part of our program.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, nice meeting you, Claire.
You too.
Hope to see you sometime.
Yes, you too.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remember to email us frequently, because we enjoy getting emails, at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and would be happy to receive it. We have, as usual, a spectacular guest on the line talking to us. This is James Peterson, who, if not the most prolific, is pretty much close to the most prolific cookbook author I know of. I think that there are 13 books to your credit, James.
Yes, that is true, Anne.
Now, I explained to you just before we went on air that I am holding your latest book called Cooking on my lap, and my legs are getting numb. It is so big.
Well, I saw I saw on Amazon that it weighs 5.5 pounds.
Well, it is filled with information.
So whatever possessed you to produce a book this large, James?
Well, I get carried away. I don't set out to produce them so large, but when I start to produce information, it just kind of comes cranking out.
And this says, as a deck, 600 recipes, 1,500 photographs, and one kitchen education, which it certainly is. I wanted to point out that you are the photographer. And these photographs are not only superb in terms of the actual food shots, but the instructional step-by-step how to do, really, those photographs really work.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So what made you think you were qualified to produce 600 recipes, James? Tell us a little bit about your
Well, it's not just the 600 recipes. It's all these instructions.
Yeah, exactly.
He tells you everything you ever want to know in a master cooking class.
There you go. So how come?
Well, I've been teaching cooking for many years, about 30 years, 25 years. So I kind of know what students need to be shown. And also, for the recipes, I've written cookbooks about single subjects. Most of my cookbooks are about things like sauces and soups and fish and vegetables. And I thought, well, what if I took sort of the creme de la creme for people who don't want to have a library? They don't want to invest in a library of all these single subject books. They want it all in one book. So that's what I've set out to do here. I wanted a book that people could say, well, you know, if I had one book for, say, a wedding present or for somebody who's just starting out cooking in life, that they'd have one book that would fulfill most of their needs. I wanted to produce that book.
So you'd call it like a magnum opus or something like that?
Yes, it's my magnum opus.
Now, I wanted to jump back a bit here. I mean, I was looking at your photograph on the back cover page. There is a name for that, and I forget. But anyhow, you're very boyish looking. And I think that a little mischievous, and it sort of makes me want to jump back and have you recount just briefly some of your development as a wild child.
Well, I dropped out of college, Anne, and
go back to where you were blowing things up in the garage.
Back to when I was blowing things up. Well, that was when I was fascinated with chemistry when I was a kid. Even before I took it in high school. In fact, in high school they said I didn't have to take it because I already knew too much about it. But I was always experimenting, and my interest veered towards things that were dangerous. If it was something dangerous, I was drawn to it, and I was fascinated with acids.
Yeah, your mother supported this whole interest. I mean, she struck me as bending over more than most mothers would to allow you to do this dangerous stuff.
Well, I won science fairs, and that got me a lot of points. You know, they knew that I wasn't just a nutcase blowing things up.
Okay.
So I won these science fairs, and then my mother would say, well, what do you need? And I'd say, well, I need nitric acid. I need this. And in those days, she could just go down to the local chemical supply place and buy all this stuff. Now I'm sure they'd check you out. They'd think you were a terrorist.
Oh, yeah.
If you bought nitric acid, because that's the base for a lot of explosives.
Right.
And I was always playing around with stuff. I had hydrofluoric acid, which is extremely deadly. You can't even get near the fumes. And I had a gas mask that I got at an Army-Navy store. And my mother would come out, and I'd be in the garage experimenting with this gas mask on. And she'd, you know, I'd be like talking in this garbled voice to her.
So how do you get from there into the kitchen where the objective presumably is not to make things explode and kill people?
Well, I studied chemistry in college, dropped out, went to India to look for a guru.
Overland. Oh, you're the only second person I knew who did that overland India.
Exactly. That's what I did. But I went backwards. Most people go from Europe to India. I went from Japan to India and then overland from India to Europe. And I had a friend who lived in Paris, and I went to stay with her. And I just fell in love with things French. I just was amazed by this whole culture that was fascinated by food. And I realized then that I had always been fascinated by food. It just never had occurred to me to do it as something, as a profession. So I undertook to learn about cooking. I came back to the United States. I worked as a short order cook for a while. Saved money to go back to France. In those days, it was possible to work as a short order cook and save money. I don't know how I did it, but I saved enough to go to Le Cordon Bleu for a while, and then I ended up working in restaurants in Paris, and that's how I learned how to cook.
Uh-huh. And then you then came back to New York, and what?
Well, then I decided, well, gee, what's the best place to cook? And in those days, Chez Panisse hadn't really taken off the ground yet. It was the only restaurant really in the West Coast that was trying to do the things that I was interested in, the sort of nouvelle cuisine and all of that. We forget what it was like, and this was 1975, 1977. We didn't have all the kind of interest in food that we have now. You couldn't buy a fresh sprig of tarragon if your life depended on it.
Yeah, you couldn't buy a mushroom.
is New York was the place to go. It was where the French restaurants were. It was where I figured I could get a job and do something significant in the kitchen. So I had a friend who was moving here, so I ended up here in New York.
Uh-huh. And so did you go back to restaurants then for working?
Well, I ended up, it's kind of a complicated story, but I ended up having a restaurant of my own in New York.
Oh, I didn't know about that. What was
yes,
that one?
It was called the Petit Robert, and I had this restaurant about 4 years. And that was a great place to learn how to cook because I could cook whatever I wanted and I could experiment. And that's where a lot of the old chemistry experimentation, where a lot of it was the same, where I was always playing around with foods and seeing what would happen when I did certain things to them.
Well, what do you think about the kitchen science now and the chemistry of food through molecular gastronomy?
Well, I think it's interesting, and it's helpful, I think, to understand that stuff. It makes you conscious of what's going on when you're making a sauce or, you know, making a mayonnaise or making a cream-based sauce or... It certainly, when it has to do with sauce making, it's very interesting to know that stuff.
You know, a lot of the things I was reading in your book actually go contrary to traditional kitchen chemistry. I mean, traditional, not kitchen chemistry, but traditional rules about how to cook.
Yes, I break a few of the rules.
You do break more than a few, I think.
Oh, maybe I'm breaking a few I don't know about.
Let me ask you, may I take you in a slightly different direction, James? How do you expect that people would use this book? You said it's a book that basically contains everything in one book, but how would you expect someone using it to be able to go about doing that? I mean, a little bit about how it's organized.
Well, it's organized in the traditional way. It's organized according to food. There's salads and soups and various meats and eggs and cheese.
Yep, you start out with the 10 basic preparations for...
Yes, that's an important part of the book. It's not a long part of the book, but it's where I break down cooking into really, I think it's 10, there are really only about 10 basic techniques that are involved in cooking. And people are always kind of amazed by that because they think they're... a multitude of things, and there are a multitude of little tasks like how to peel things and chop things and all those kind of things, but the basic techniques like braising and stewing and frying, and they're really only about 10. So those are broken down in the very beginning of the book, and then I show in the content of the book, I show how to use those techniques and how to apply them to different foods.
Yeah, well, you have some funny things under assumptions here, too. For example, salt, now in the heyday of sea salt, you say use when it rains it pours, which is Morton's table salt, right?
Well, what I'm trying to get, the point I'm trying to get across is people get stuck with these things. They think their food isn't going to be any good unless they have fleur de sel. And it's just not true. The effect of fleur de sel on a dish, it's beautiful in a photograph because it has those wonderful kind of cleaving crystals. But in terms of the taste of the dish, it's not going to make an enormous difference.
Well, it's a finishing salt anyhow.
Yes, it's for finishing, and I don't want to see people get stuck with these having to use these exotic ingredients.
Even in wine, for example, you go against all the recommendations that of most cooking chefs or instructional chefs or whatever you want to cook it, saying you do not use your best bottle of wine.
Well, no, I don't. Most of what makes a wine special is lost when it's cooked. Most of the finesse of a wine is lost. The structure of a wine is important. You want a wine with a lot of body. You want, ideally, a wine with some bottle age. But you don't need a wine with a great deal of finesse.
Okay,
I once, as an experiment, made a sauce with a bottle, half a bottle of Echizo that someone had left at the restaurant. And it was a waste. It was barely perceptible. It was perceptible that maybe I'd use Burgundy in the sauce, but that was the extent of it.
There you go. Well, let's do a working experiment. And listeners, we really didn't spring this on James because we let him know before we began the interview. Let's suppose that it's the 23rd of December, which it is, and you still don't have any idea what you're going to cook for Christmas. So, James, where in the book would they go?
Well, I always cook turkey for Christmas. I'm traditional in that way, and I cook turkey it's very simple. In fact, I, for Thanksgiving, had been invited out for dinner, so I didn't have any turkey leftovers. And then the Saturday after Thanksgiving, I was at the supermarket and saw this turkey. It was on sale. This big turkey for $11. And I thought, well, let's have turkey for dinner. And it was 9 o'clock at night. So I made turkey dinner. We ate at midnight, but we had turkey dinner.
And how are you going to recommend that people fix turkey on Christmas Day?
Well, there are a few tips. It's basically very straightforward, but there are a few tips. And one of them, for example, is to let the turkey come to room temperature before you roast it. That way it cooks much more evenly. And I suggest starting it out at a relatively high temperature so that it browns. And another technique that I show in the book is to make a little bit of make a little aluminum foil covering for the breast. And that slows down the cooking time of the breast meat so that it cooked evenly with the thigh meat.
And my mother always did that. So I'm assuming my grandmother probably did too.
Yeah, it's funny, James. We had our local slow food chapter organized a turkey dinner with all kinds of different heritage turkeys, including a wild turkey. It was absolutely incredible, the difference in the cooking. But Anne thought she had made a great coup because she actually managed to get the rest of the carcass with the breast removed of the wild turkey, and we brought it home. With the sharpest knife in our possession, we couldn't even chip off.
I think it was a cleaver.
We couldn't even chip off the leg meat.
The wild turkey is so tough.
Oh, the whole thing was tough.
So the breast was fine, but the rest of the bird was inedible.
Did you make soup out of it?
I can't remember. I'm not even sure it was soupable.
I love turkey soup. I love to make a turkey broth, and then I use the broth to make onion soup.
Uh-huh.
Big French onion soup. It's delicious.
Yeah, well, I got a knuckle wrap 2 days after Thanksgiving. We cooked only a small turkey at Thanksgiving this year because we didn't have very many guests. But then 2 days after Christmas, I took all the meat off the bones and then I threw the bones out.
I was very upset.
And Anne was very upset. She said, turkey soup is what I want. I said, well, you can fish it out of the trash if you like. It
hasn't been, under the dirty diaper.
hasn't been in there for very long. but she really didn't do that.
Now, one question here is your techniques. You go through all these techniques, including convention. I didn't find any reference to induction. Is that the next thing to look out for?
Well, I've only used induction once, and I used it the wrong way. I used an induction stove, but I didn't use the right pot.
Oh, that's bad, yeah.
I used a regular pot on the induction stove, and I was with some friends out at a beach house we had rented, which had this induction stove, and we were making I was steaming a lobster in a big pot. Well, the lobster took forever to cook because it wasn't supposed to be, of course, on an induction stove.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Did you
wreck the pot, too?
That lobster was the best I've ever tasted.
It just took a long time to cook.
It's about 3 hours to cook.
Well, like sous vide or something. Yeah.
I don't know. I was not doing it right. But yeah. I don't like things where I have to use a particular pot or pan.
Yeah, see, that worries me, too, because I have all these all-clad pans that I don't know what.
You want to be able to use them.
Yeah, I know. Well, listen, you and I could go on and on, and Peter could go on and on. I haven't given him much of a chance to set in here. But let's get the basics. The book is titled again, Cooking, and the author is James Peterson, who we're talking to, author of 13 other books. And you can get this by going to onthemenuradio.com, OTM bookshelf.
Yep.
Just click right through and get it. And how about a personal website? Do you have one of those, James?
Well, I have two. I have one that's called jimcooks.com.
Okay.
And I have one that's called jamespetersonstudios.com.
Oh, that's the photography?
That's for the photography, yes.
Yeah, and I would say, listeners, get this book for all the information, and get this book for the very clear, straightforward writing style, which is it's a real boon, Jim.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and also get it for the photographs. And anybody who needs any kind of photography, food photography, check out this man. He knows food, so his photographs are that much better.
Okay, and now I think we're going to do this classic, it's time to take a break. So stay with us, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com. www.thefrenchlawn.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Do you have your ears tuned in here, listeners? Because I'm going to give you a sample of what I'm doing. Hold on. Can you hear that? I've gone crackers for Mary's Gone Crackers, and we have actually the founder of the company called Mary's Gone Crackers, Mary Waldner, here on the line. Hello, Mary.
Hi.
Of course, you know I've already raved on about these crackers to you on the phone.
Yeah.
I can't stop eating them. Tell us a little bit about your background. I mean, are you one of these people who invented these crackers in your kitchen table?
I did, actually. In my other life, I've been a marriage and family therapist. I was in private practice for 26 years.
You'd have thought you knew better than to go into business when you're
in. Yeah, and I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd be doing this in my 50s, but in 94 I was diagnosed with celiac disease, and I've always been a foodie and kind of a health nut, because I knew intuitively that what was wrong with me had to do with what I was eating, but I never knew what it was, and so I've always played with food and baked a lot, and so I started developing a lot of different recipes that I could eat, and the crackers came out of that process.
Now, you founded this with your husband in 1999, right?
Yes.
It says you woke up on New Year's Day.
Yes. Well, you know, I'd been making these crackers for years by hand and giving them, you know, for myself, really, and my son, who also has celiac disease. And everywhere we went, people flipped over them. And after making them over and over and over, and I got a new oven so I could make more, and I said that I thought we should manufacture them, because I knew nobody would make them. Even if I gave people the recipe, they were just too labor-intensive. And he, in his naivete, said, okay. And it took us several years to learn about equipment and learn about the industry. He wrote a business plan, and we raised money, and so we didn't actually get into production until 2004.
But what's with this name?
Well, the name it took us a long time to try and find a name. And as I said, I've been a therapist for a long time, and I was in a women's group where I brought this issue to the table and said that I was having a hard time coming up with a name. And one of the women in the group said, well, I think your name should be in it. It should be like Mary's Cracking Up or something like that. And then my other friend said, yeah, Mary's Gone Crackers, and that was it.
And that was probably a very good reflection of what you were doing at the time.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Absolutely. I was cracking up. I was making crackers. Other than working and sleeping, I was in the kitchen making crackers.
Now, what makes these so good? I mean, I have no relationship to the disease, mm-hmm. or to any food allergies or anything, mm-hmm. except that I do hear a lot about them. There's plenty of this around.
But they just, right. the key thing is, they just taste good.
They taste so good.
They do, and I think that people really enjoy that crunch. I think that, you know, there's a lot I've been experimenting with cookies, and people have strong feelings about whether they want chewy cookies or crunchy cookies, but when it comes to a cracker, people really love crunch, and so that's part of it. But I think there's a couple things. There's a really toasty flavor that is very rich and satisfying, but also I think the seeds in there, the flax seeds and the sesame seeds, not only gives it a good flavor, but there's something, that kind of fat is something that most of us are really depleted in, and once you start eating it, I think the body is really happy to be getting that in its system. And
yeah, but it's only 9 calories a cracker.
It's not a lot of calories, but the fat that's in those seeds is a really good kind of fat for us. We don't add any fat in the process of making them at all, so it's just the grains. And
it
the
says seeds. Here there are 5 varieties, the original, mm-hmm. black pepper, caraway, herb, and onion.
Right.
And they are made of organic whole grain brown rice, organic quinoa, organic flax seeds, organic brown sesame seeds.
Right.
No added fat. I mean, it's a wonder they work.
It is.
Well, you say on the box, Mary, you wrote on the box. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a challenge. How can cookies made out of these really dull ingredients taste so good?
Right, right. Because when people look at the ingredients, they think it's going to be kind of boring. But it's also the whole grains instead of flour. We don't use any flour. It's actually the real grains. So those are very flavorful.
Now, I mean, you don't know this, I'm sure, but I'm amazed because we have a 10-month-old granddaughter.
Mm.
And the list of the food stuff that they give them, that they have to be careful. They can't give them this and they can't give them that and they can't. Mm-hmm. And wheat was one of them for a long time. And, I mean, we never worried about any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that the incidence is up?
Absolutely. And I think it's a couple of different reasons. I think one is that most of the wheat that we've eaten now over the last probably 50 or more years is very hybridized. So we're not getting the varieties of wheat that we used to get. So people develop allergies to wheat, not just the... And the gluten issue is not an allergy. It's actually an intolerance.
Intolerance.
I think that it's been known, other countries know about it much more than we do in the U.S., and it's not that it hasn't been there, it's just that we're finally recognizing it. There are so many different symptoms that people can have with that illness that it's not like a consistent thing, so that makes it more confusing, too.
Now, are there some products behind this, Mary, or is Mary just going to go crackers with crackers?
Well, no. Like I said, I've been playing with cookies, so I'm hoping to get those out relatively soon. And we're also coming out with another whole grain snack that's going to be it's kind of in the shape of a pretzel, but, again, no flour or wheat. It's just going to be whole grain. So that should be coming out early next year.
Look out for a product from a company called Liz Lovely in Vermont.
I know.
Do you know them? Do you know they're vegan cookies?
I actually heard your interview, and I've met them at trade shows.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Now, I can't eat their cookies, but they look wonderful.
Oh, they taste wonderful too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you did tell me that you had met them. So I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm glad you reminded us of that. And when your interview airs, I'll be sure to send them a note too, and so they can listen in to what you had to say.
Okay.
But how do people get some of these wonderful cookies? I mean,
well,
crackers.
Well, we are we're nationwide distribution now. We're in Whole Foods, Wild Oats, lots of co-op health food stores. We're in Wegmans and some of the Publix in Florida. Depends. There's some in Kroger's nationwide now. So we're getting into regular grocery stores a little bit, but definitely your local health food store should have them.
That's wonderful. Is there a store locator on your website?
Yes, there is.
Okay, and
the
website is?
Mary'sGoneCrackers.com.
nothing like rubbing it in, huh?
Right.
Do you still practice?
No, actually, I did keep my practice for a while, but it's been 2 years now that I shut down. I've been traveling so much, and I just couldn't do it.
Well, will you be at the Fancy Food Show in New York in July?
Yes, absolutely.
Then be sure to look for us then. I know you have my phone number.
Yes.
And we'll definitely be there. I don't think we're going to San Diego, but...
Do you have a booth there, or do you just walk?
Oh, no. We're on the buy side, or at least the representative of the press side.
Okay.
Always looking for exciting new products.
Come and visit our booth. We
absolutely will do that. It would be a pleasure to meet you.
It's a wonderful
story, Mary. We wish you continued success.
Well, thank you.
And Mary, everybody who tastes them just goes nuts over them. These are people that have no concern with the health benefits whatsoever.
Right.
They taste great.
They go crackers just like me. Yeah.
Well, Mary Gone Crackers, happy holiday season to you, what's left of it. Thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Listeners, we're going to go take a break now, and we hope you'll stay with us and listen to us on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back to On the Menu. Don't forget that you can keep in touch with all our activities at our website, www.onthemenuradio.com. You can send us emails. We'd love to hear from you at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Nice and easy for you to be able to remember. And for the convenience, if you prefer it, you can even actually do that straight from our website. There's a special place to click that you can do that. On the Menu sometimes has the fortunate opportunity to be able to span the globe with a single guest. And Cecilia Chang, who's our next guest upcoming, has done exactly that because she started out her life more than half a world away. Cecilia, welcome to On the Menu. Tell us about this really long journey that's been your life in food.
You want me started when I was a child?
It sounds like I was born at an early age, they always say.
I was born in China, and I was born in Beijing. I was born in Shanghai, and then I was educated in Beijing when I was a child. I don't even quite remember exactly the age, probably 4 or 5 years old. So my family from Shanghai moved to Beijing from south to north. And that time, Beijing was the old capital of China.
And this was a China that we wouldn't recognize today, correct?
Yes, that's old China and old Beijing. And we leave our home just somewhere about 10 minutes from Forbidden City, Tiananmen Square, just near that area.
Now, your book is called The Seventh Daughter because you were the seventh of 10 children?
Seventh daughter because I came from a big family. We have 12 children by the
12.
Same parent, and the 9 girls and the 3 boys. So I'm the number 7.
Oh, see, I thought there were 10
daughter.
To 12.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes.
However many bathrooms did you have for that many daughters?
9 daughters.
9 daughters. How many bathrooms?
Yeah. So I'm almost, I have 2 younger sisters. So I'm also kind of the little one in our family, always well sheltered by... Yeah. You know, my parents and also by my older brothers, sisters.
Yeah, now you went from a very privileged, sheltered childhood through the whole Cultural Revolution, as it's called in China,
yes.
To probably one of the saddest points in the book was when your father died, when you went returned.
Yes.
What year was that?
Yes, when I remember, since I was a child, I remember we have many wars in China. You know, the Silver War. You know, the Civil War, and always the landlord fighting each other about the territory. You know, this is mine, that is. Always fighting. And I remember. Then later, the 1937, Japanese invade China, started from Manchuria, and then occupied Beijing. And that time, I was in the little school. Then later on, they moved in. Anyway, all kinds of wars. So when they were occupied most part of China, then I left with my sister. Number 5 sister.
Uh-huh.
We walked from Beijing to Chongqing.
That was an amazing journey.
Yeah, that was a long, long journey. We walked about 5 months to get to Chongqing. And by that time, our whole body full of fleas. And we got in the hair, in the clothes, just about everywhere. Anyway, so we got in the Free China. So... finally, we found, we didn't know anybody. And, you know, those days we didn't even have a map. We just walked from village to village and asked people, what is the next stop? What is the next stop? And then during that time, the Japanese airplane was on the air. And also they used the machine gun to kill all these innocent people. So I remember very well one day we were near Henan province. In the early morning, and the airplane started shooting, and so we just happened that day we were on the road. So we heard the Japanese plane, so we hide in the field in the field, and covered with the corn plants.
And you seem to very quickly understand, to jump from this privileged background, this protected background, what the rules were for living and surviving.
Surviving,
and your book is just, it traces all of your adventures in learning how to survive and to thrive. And I think, and it gets to this point where you come to San Francisco, what a brave thing, and opened a restaurant all the way on your own.
Yeah.
And then brought your children over, left your husband in Tokyo. I mean, you are a very independent woman.
But that time I didn't know that.
You didn't know any better.
Didn't realize, you know, and just things happened that way, because if I didn't, by mistake, get bought the restaurant by mistake, I probably still ended in Japan. Very planned housewife and take care of the kids.
I can't picture that, because, I mean, I should mention, in case our readers don't, or our listeners don't know, that that your restaurant, the Mandarin, really exposed Americans to real, authentic Chinese cooking for the first time.
Yes.
And became, I mean, you had every celebrity in the world as a patron there.
That's right. Mm.
And that, what an exciting time that was. You know, the restaurant is closed, but you've continued the legacy in this book with all your recipes.
Now, Cecilia, how were you able to do that? I mean, Chinatown in San Francisco already existed. It was serving, you know, what passed for Chinese food in the United States. I mean, how was it that you were able, just yourself, to be able to do this?
But when I first came to San Francisco, you know, I didn't know anybody. I only know one person. That was my sister, number six. So she was alone. She lost her husband. So I came here to comfort her. So we walked to Chinatown, she didn't do any cooking, and I didn't do any much cooking either. So we just went to Chinatown and eat, because her apartment just on the edge of Power and the Clay, you know, just on the edge of outside Chinatown. So we just walked down so we can get all kinds of these little restaurants. And the food was terrible. Whenever we go, the same menu, they copy each other. And the chop suey, you know, egg foyong, that kind of thing. So I asked my sister, I said, this is something we never had when we were in China. I said, well, she said, you got no choice. That's the way it is here, you know. And mostly the owner of the restaurants they didn't have much education. And this is something they create themselves. Yeah, and then they copy each other.
I see.
And they are quite busy. All the business are pretty busy. And only one restaurant, I think, is have a tablecloth and have a long bar, serve cocktails. That was Johnny Can.
Uh-huh.
Can's on Grand Avenue. All the rest, the Chinese restaurants are very, very small. Most of the restaurants don't have a tablecloth, no napkins, you know.
Yeah, so you added this whole ambience of upscale elegance, a really refinement to the whole of Chinese cuisine in a restaurant.
So that time I just thought about, after, you know, I got this list, and my friends are back off. So I said, well, I have to do something really different with what they do in the Chinatown. I really want to introduce the real authentic Chinese food to Americans.
And you did.
And that's the whole thing. And then another thing is, I said, my restaurant I want to look like just like old temple in China. I don't want, so I told the architect, I don't want anything red, no red, no gold, no dragons.
No dragons. I remember reading that. That was funny.
And no red Latin. Because all the Chinese restaurants, they look the same. They all have dragons, a lot of red lanterns. a lot of gold fillers, you know, all that.
Now, Cecilia, where did you get the recipe? I mean, you were obviously cooking now to recipes that were new to San Francisco. I mean, did you have these from when you were growing up, or did you?
I really never cooked in my life time. Yeah, I remember the taste of my mother's. My mother was a very good cook, and also we have two cooks at home. One cooked the northern part of Chinese food, and one cooked Shanghainese food. So I always remembered what we had when we were young. So I remembered. And then before I came here, I had a restaurant in Tokyo.
Oh, okay. So you weren't a rookie to the restaurant business when you came to San Francisco.
That's before I came to United States. So, but when I was in Japan, I was in the kitchen all the time, and I watched them how to do things, you know. But I never really cooked because that was a big restaurant, about 300 seats.
Well, you've accomplished so much with your life, and you've traversed so much history, and anybody who gets this book will find that the whole fascinating history. I told you I read it cover to cover. It's a page turner, and also the recipes, which are emphasizing the pure, simple food of China, and they're just brilliant recipes.
Because I saw this book, probably a lot of women going to read it, you know. So, and also I try to make the housewives probably like to try the recipes. So I make the recipes as simple as possible. And also it's very tasty and very easy to follow all the recipes.
Yes.
Recently I had quite a few book signing parties here in town. They serve a little lunch and they pick up a few dishes.
Uh-huh.
And serve. They all said it's so easy to follow and also tastes very good.
Well, the New York Times just said that it was one of the best cookbooks of the year, right?
Yes.
Well, I agree. And anybody who wants to get it now, it's Cecilia Chang. It's called The Seventh Daughter, My Culinary Journey from Beijing to San Francisco. And you can get it on our website, on the menu, radio.com, and the
OTM bookshelf is where you'll find it. And Cecilia, are there restaurateurs in San Francisco who are following your tradition? I mean, you closed your restaurant. I guess you felt you had reached retirement age, so you stopped it. Are there Chinese restaurants that are maintaining your tradition, do you think?
I think right now, like, we have quite a few dishes. Nobody ever make it. I just don't know why. Like the minced squab.
That's good.
That's the one I created. That's the kind of our signature dish. But now nobody uses the squab. They all use either pork or chicken minced, you know, and not quite taste the same. And also baked chicken. And then, you know, Chuck Williams always said, why, Cecilia, after you retired and nobody cooked that baked chicken anymore?
Yeah, that's you're talking about.
They tried to copy it and somehow it just didn't work.
So if they get it from this book, will it work?
Yeah, and also I had the smoked tea duck. That's all our signature dish, and they are really delicious. Some dishes are really outstanding. Even in the old days, some friends from Hong Kong, Taiwan, they came here. This is all these few dishes. We cannot even get in China anymore.
Have you been back to China, Cecilia?
I just came back actually about a month ago from China. Yeah. I went to China. And then I went to Japan.
And are they ready for the Olympics?
I go there every year.
And are they ready for the Olympics?
Yes, I hope I can go.
There you go, yes.
I try. Since I can, you know, for my age, you never know. Someday you cannot walk anymore. So since I still can walk, I try my best.
You sound just fine.
Thank you.
So, listeners, this is an adventure story. With a real-life heroine. It's a cookbook with simple but genuine Chinese food. You should buy a copy, and I'm going to say to Miss Anne, she should start cooking from it.
Yes. See what you got me into, Cecilia.
She's in trouble now because you said it was easy.
Yeah. A lot of people tried, and they all said very easy to follow and very tasty. Oh, I have I met a young lady the other day in the Bokchan party. She is only about 15. She said, I tried your sesame seed, shrimp, and also the salad. She said, "My turned out very good. My mother said, I can do it again." that was so cute.
that's just a wonderful testament to a life well lived. I think, Cecilia, I suspect that whatever's been going on, you've always managed to enjoy yourself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And we thank you for being part of On the Menu. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
Yes, and next time we're in San Francisco, we'll call. Okay. Bye, yeah. Cecilia.
Okay, bye. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice talk to you.
You too.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
And listeners, that's a wrap for another session of On the Menu. We hope you enjoyed being a part of the show, and you'll join us again, same time, same place, next week. And of course, we should sign off by wishing you all the very best for the Christmas and the rest of the holiday season.